Welcome to the first of Mary Jo McCarthy's audio legal briefs, Contract Essentials for Smaller Business Owners. It's been said that it takes passion and commitment to start, run, and grow a small business, and I don't disagree with that. It's what comes after those emotions, however, which separates the small business owners who will succeed and prosper from those who may falter and struggle. It's what keeps me up at night, knowing that I need more than passion for the law to help me guide my small business clients as they build, preserve, and protect what they have worked so hard to create. Benjamin Franklin believed that in this world nothing is certain but death and taxes, but small business lawyers strive for more certainty in their clients' businesses than Franklin thought existed. We believe certainty, or as much certainty as can be found in business today, is fostered by paying attention to the details while simultaneously looking to the stars for vision. Vision with a solid foundation will thrive, but vision without a solid foundation won't be sustainable. One of the most elemental building blocks of every business is the contract. Oral or written, informal or formal, short or long, we all sell our services and products with the aid of a contract. It tells us when to begin, when to end, what to pay, and to whom we pay it, what to produce, and for whom. Well, you get the picture. So let's narrow our business focus to that ever-so-important document and see if we can agree on some fundamentals and strip it of some mystery. This recording is copyrighted 2009 by Widette & McCarthy, PC. The information you obtain on this CD is not, nor is it intended to be, legal advice. You should consult an attorney for individual advice regarding your own situation. When is a contract not a contract? A client called me this week with some good news. His graphic design business was picking up. He had weathered a tough economy, and orders for his services were coming in on a more regular basis. As we chatted, however, he said something that gave me pause. All of a sudden, I have no time to deal with contracts. I just have to get my proposals out the door. We're already working for the client before we have time to deal with a contract. I pursued that a bit, not wanting to sound like a super cautious lawyer, but still wanting to raise the issue of protecting my client's valuable services. A few more minutes of conversation elicited that, in many instances, my client was providing services to clients for whom his company had worked in the past, so he was comfortable with the relationship. Gulp. Now, don't get me wrong. In most instances, an oral contract is as legal as a written contract, with the exception of real estate. So yes, my client's proposal certainly constitutes more evidence of a contract than two parties who just begin to do business with each other with no other formalities. But it's that very concept which made me take a big gulp and suggest that he consider some essential elements of the contract for which he has no evidence. Let's just highlight a few. What's the time frame, and what are the client's expectations? In other words, when do the services you provide begin, and when do they end? How are you to be paid, and when? What happens if you aren't paid on time? Can you stop work? Can you terminate the contract? Can you charge interest on late payments? What happens if you have to pursue collection activity against a non-paying client? Can you include your lawyer's fees in the final demand for payment? Who owns the product which your services create? And most important, when it comes to creative work, how is the client's approval measured? In other words, when can you stop doing revisions on your nickel? And when do those endless changes become the client's responsibility? Well, I could go on, but you get the gist. When you provide a service to clients and just plow ahead, there's a risk. Nobody, not you, not your client, has agreed in verifiable format on the essential terms of the contract into which you both have just entered. Again, let me stress this fact. You may very well have a contract, but how do you prove the details? So here's a suggestion for professional service providers. Create a basic boilerplate contract which covers all of the essentials and attach a description of your work, which of course varies with every single client. Do not put your talented services at risk by leaving the end result to the memory of others. You'd be amazed at how those memories fade when it comes time to pay the bill, particularly if you haven't been billing the client monthly as work progresses. Now, having said that and shared with you the strong warning I gave my client, there are indeed times when an oral contract may be preferable. But that's a discussion for another day. Contracts, contracts, contracts. Read them well. Contracts are important documents. For many entrepreneurs, they are the lifeblood of the business. Written agreements which specify, sometimes in great detail, the terms and conditions for the sale of a product or service. Not a week goes by without a client asking for a contract review. So many of my clients show the foresight and value judgment to ask for advice in advance, and that's great. It's where I can really bring care and concern to the transaction at the time when the other party wants to do business with my client and is willing to reasonably negotiate in order to seal the deal. So far, so good. Having passed the first milestone, that is, having given or received a written agreement for your product or service, you naturally proceed to perform or await performance by the other party. All seems to be going well. Both parties are satisfied, proceeding with the work, billing and paying for services rendered on a monthly basis, and then, all of a sudden, a hiccup occurs. It's not unusual. It's not bad. It's business. So now what? Well, if you are like most entrepreneurs, you sort out the issue, agree to the solution, and move on. But wait a minute. Didn't you forget something? In the blur that becomes our daily business lives, too often we forget that most important last step. We forgot to document both parties' agreement to that hiccup solution. Both parties were satisfied at the time, but will surely have vague memories of the resolution months down the road when the contract is complete and it comes time for final payment. It's not deliberate or scheming on the side of either party. It's just natural. What's the final step in resolving that hiccup? Document it, of course. And document it according to the terms of the written contract which you signed months ago and haven't looked at since. There are two standard provisions in every contract, or there should be if you have reviewed and negotiated the contract up front. One provision is what we call modifications, and the other is notice. The first tells you how the contract can be modified, and the second tells you what process to use to do so. The first provision tells you that modifications, undoubtedly, the resolution of that first hiccup involved a solution which strayed from the terms of the original contract, which is okay, since both parties agreed, must be in writing and signed by both parties. The second provision specifies in detail what form that writing must take, usually fax, certified mail, overnight mail, and when the notice is actually effective, immediately upon receipt via fax, upon signature, or refusal of certified, well, you get the picture. Of course, so much of what we document nowadays is done electronically that we may be tempted to do a shortcut and simply document the resolution via email, which, for the uninitiated, unless electronic mail is included in the notice provisions of your contract, is a technical violation of the terms agreed to. However, an exchange of emails can at the very least show that both parties agreed to the contract shortcut and will serve you in good stead down the road. So what's my advice? After both parties have agreed to the change, and before you move on to implement it, revisit the contract. Follow the contract provisions for modification and notice of such modification. Just as you documented the original agreement in writing, be sure you document any change to the agreement in writing, in at least some format, even if informally. Remember, if it's true that a contract is only as good as the paper it's written on, it's also true for the modifications. Make sure to give these the same attention you gave to the original document. When in doubt, document. Remember the old days when a handshake was all it took to create a binding agreement? Wouldn't it be nice if they were still around? There's an adage in the real estate industry, who knows how these little sayings get started, that says the key to success for a real estate owner is location, location, location. If that's true, then I would call your attention to an adage in business, and I did not just make this up, which says, when in doubt, document, document, document. No matter what the agreement is, no matter how long you've been doing business with each other, no matter how minor it seems, create a record of that oral agreement. Let me share a little story with you. No names to protect the innocent. A smart, successful client called me recently with a question about a problem she was having with a customer. Seems she and her customer entered into a solid written contract a year ago. So far, so good. However, along the way, my client called that customer and asked her to make a change in the contract, a change which turned out to be rather material in the scheme of things. The customer agreed, and neither party gave it another thought, since the parties had done business for a number of years. In other words, the parties trusted each other, and nobody bothered to read the boilerplate in that contract, which said that modifications should be made in writing. Well, this little story has a rather sad ending. Along came a purchaser of the customer's business who bought it, and when the contract came up for renewal, and my client explained the change that both parties had orally agreed to, the new owner, quite understandably, said that the change appeared nowhere in the contract, he had no knowledge of it, and furthermore, he refused to be bound by it. In the long run, this cost my client a substantial sum of money, left behind a very bad taste, and suffice it to say, they are no longer doing business together. The moral of this little story? If my client had just sent off a quick email to the customer outlining the change to which they had both agreed, with a request to the customer to confirm, the outcome might have been very different. So let's recap based upon this very real example. Number one, always, always, always get the agreement in writing, the original contract, as well as any changes or renewals. Number two, stuff happens, as they say, and you definitely want to document that stuff as you proceed through the contract term. And when I say document, it can be as simple as a letter or an email, as long as both parties acknowledge the change. Signatures on a formal modification are always nice, but email correspondence can be very powerful evidence of mutual agreement in the event of a dispute. And number three, read, 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 and then read again. There's a reason they put the gotchas in small print, you know. Boilerplate in contracts, a dangerous thing to ignore. Recently, one of my clients called me in a panic because his company had been sued, in Texas, no less. He wanted to know why and how and what to do about it. As it turns out, he entered into a contract with a vendor 2 years ago. Never had the contract reviewed by counsel, since it was just a few pages of boilerplate, and now, sadly, has to spend time and money trying to protect his rights in a state to which he has never even traveled. Can they really sue me in Texas? He squawked in frustration. After reviewing the contract, I had the unhappy job of explaining what it meant when he agreed to jurisdiction in the state of Texas for all matters relating to the contract. Even worse, I had to explain what it meant to have agreed in writing that the losing party in litigation pays the legal fees and costs of the winning party. That, my friends, is an example of boilerplate you do not want to ignore. What can you do to prevent such unpleasant surprises? Well, that's why we negotiate contracts. Sometimes you can effectively change the outcome of some of these kinds of provisions. Other times, while you can't change the outcome, you can at least be better prepared for the possibility. Sound like typical lawyer waffling? Maybe yes, maybe no. A little lawyer humor here. Every deal into which you enter is supported, I hope, by a written contract. A contract which contains lots of provisions, some of which are negotiable, some of which may not be, depending upon the relative strength or weakness of the parties, the deal itself, the market into which you sell, the industry, etc. All of these things impact your ability to negotiate. For example, if you own a two-person consulting firm and you are about to enter into a transaction with Microsoft, now there's a boilerplate contract, do not expect to negotiate any of that boilerplate. Your review of that contract under those circumstances should be limited to the practicalities of A, confirming the business terms, and B, understanding how the balance of the contract may affect you in the future. So, to return to my client's example, if his contract had been with Microsoft, he should have expected to have to resolve all matters in accordance with the laws of the state of Washington, whether within the walls of its courts or through arbitration. Another nasty little surprise buried in the boilerplate for those who merely scan contracts before they sign them. Egad! If, however, his contract had been negotiated with a peer, he should have considered which of the provisions were essential to the deal, which weren't, and proceeded to negotiate accordingly. To summarize, here are a few tips which should stand you in good stead the next time a boilerplate contract comes flying through your email. Number one, do not assume that a contract is always non-negotiable boilerplate. Consider the elements of the deal before you make that assumption, and even then, confer with a more objective voice of experience. Number two, if it is non-negotiable, like Microsoft, understand the ramifications of what you are agreeing to. That is, after all, what you have done when you sign the contract. Number three, if it is non-negotiable, weigh the pros and cons of moving forward with that contract in the first place. Yes, that's right. Do not always take that final step if you are uncomfortable with the written contract and the other party is intractable about any revisions. Remember that two parties enter into a contract which by itself envisions some compromise by each party, unless you are the 800-pound gorilla in the industry. If you find the other contracting party that rigid at the beginning of the transaction, think about what it will be like to work with them and consider just saying no. And number four, review all contracts thoroughly. Do not give short shrift to the boilerplate. It may come back to haunt you. And always, always consider highlighting your areas of concern, being reasonable and practical as you do so, and discussing them with the other party. You will be amazed at the result. The first thing we do, let's pay all the lawyers. Another gotcha in boilerplate contracts. Let's start with a simple premise. No small business owner likes to pay legal bills. It's okay to admit it. Legal bills are sort of like taxes, sometimes painful, often inevitable, but hopefully you received something of value. However, here's an ugly twist. Suppose you ended up in a dispute with a vendor or customer. You couldn't sort it out amicably. You ended up in litigation. You lost, and then you were told that not only do you have to pay your own lawyer, you have to pay the other party's lawyer as well. And to make matters worse, the other party is a large business, 10 times your size, and they used a mega law firm which assigned multiple lawyers to the litigation. How could this happen? Well, for starters, it is entirely possible that you signed a boilerplate contract which included a paragraph of teeny tiny print that read something like this, quote, attorney fees. In the event that any party to this agreement shall commence any suit or action to interpret or enforce this agreement, the prevailing party in such action shall recover that party's costs and expenses incurred in connection with the suit or action, including attorney fee and costs of appeal, if any. Close quote. In English, if you have to sue a vendor or customer on this particular contract and you lose, you pay their costs and their lawyers. How does this put a small business at a disadvantage? Think about it for a moment. You're a small business and your client is a large business. You have a terrific lawyer whose fees are reasonable. They use a large law firm where standard operating procedure is to put a $500 an hour partner, two $350 an hour associates, and a $150 an hour paralegal on a litigation dispute. It's called intimidation by size, and it happens all the time. Do you think that will give you pause before you sue to enforce your rights under that contract? You bet it will. And if your lawyer is really on the ball, once she sees the boilerplate contract you would be suing to enforce, she is likely to ask that ever-important question, do you really want to risk losing and having a $10,000 dispute turn into a $100,000 bad result? Where did this come from? The so-called American rule under the common law is that each party pays its own expenses in litigation, including attorney fees. The American rule differs substantially from the English rule. No surprise there. English courts award litigation costs to the prevailing party, reasoning that absent another's wrongful conduct, the prevailing party would have had no reason to undergo litigation. Unfortunately, the so-called English rule has started to creep into our business practices, and at some point in the near future, it is very likely that you will be presented with a boilerplate contract containing a version of the English rule. Without boring you with a judicial background on this whole issue, I would tell you that our courts have upheld the American rule time after time, except when private parties to a private contract have agreed in advance otherwise. When that happens, you're stuck with what you have allegedly negotiated, whether or not you actually negotiated this provision or even saw it. What's a small business owner to do? Number one, be aware and be vigilant. They call them boilerplate contracts for a reason. You'll find everything, including the kitchen sink, in some of them. If you know what you are looking for, you can save yourself some anxious moments in the future. The decision to pursue your contract rights via litigation is a huge decision, one that should not be burdened by worrying about who pays the other guy's legal bills if you feel you have been wronged. Number two, just say no. Contracts are meant to be as mutually acceptable to both parties as is possible. A fair contract is a written agreement of a business deal. It is not meant to be unfairly one-sided, nor is it meant to squash a small business owner's rights. Sometimes it just means saying no to the provision. Sometimes it means saying no to a contract. You control the final decision, and you should weigh all of the pros and cons when presented with a contract. And number three, if you agree to pay their lawyers, know what the deal is. Informed consent is occasionally the only option. You may really want the business, and the other party may be the only game in town. Whatever your reasons are for signing a contract that includes this kind of provision, they are your reasons. Reasons that may very well have merit after you have weighed all of the factors and knowledgeably signed the contract. The bottom line to all this is read, reread, and read again. I have a client whose due diligence before every major business transaction includes forwarding a copy of the proposed contract to me for review and comment. Sometimes he accepts all of my recommendations, sometimes he doesn't. But either way, he makes an informed decision going forward. And that may just be the best outcome we can all expect. Five tips to protect your business with a confidentiality agreement. Not a week goes by without my receiving an email from a client regarding a confidentiality agreement. Either they are being asked to sign one and aren't sure what to do, or they are wondering if they should be asking someone else to enter into an agreement. And while these documents offer important protection between your company and its vendors, customers, employees, and consultants, there are a few things you want to make sure you understand before you sign on the dotted line. Because, after all, a confidentiality agreement is a contract with serious obligations, violations of which, whether through negligent or intentional acts, can cost you time and money in court, time and money which could be avoided with a small amount of advance preparation. Most small business owners are familiar with the two most prevalent uses for confidentiality agreements. When an entrepreneur is interested in kicking the tires of a competitor's business, preparatory to making an offer to purchase, he or she will be asked to sign a confidentiality agreement. And when hiring a key employee who will have access to the company's protected confidential information, that employee will be asked to sign. In both of these common cases, confidentiality agreements are obvious, routine, and an accepted practice. Many entrepreneurs, however, ignore the need for confidentiality agreements in their day-to-day business, as they share their company's customer lists and business strategies with these same vendors, customers, clients, and consultants. Anytime, yes, anytime, this type of information will be shared with an outsider, you should consider executing a confidentiality agreement. When you do, here are five tips on doing it effectively. Number one, do not sign a contract which imposes confidentiality obligations on your company without legal review prior to signing the agreement. The key word in the previous sentence is prior. As most small business lawyers agree, it's far easier to protect our clients before they sign than to get them out of trouble after the fact. Even more distressing are the myriad situations where someone else shoves one of these contracts in front of you, which you barely glance at, sign, and hand back without even asking for a copy of the contract you just signed on behalf of your company. Egad! Whatever happened to asking counsel to review all of your substantive contracts, not just the ones with the dollar signs clearly affixed. Number two, do propose a mutual confidentiality agreement as part of the deal. Both parties will be protected, both parties will assume similar obligations, and both parties will respect the other for good business practices. Number three, do look for certain standard exceptions from the confidentiality obligations. If there are none, it is a harsh, restrictive, and unfairly drafted agreement. For example, if you have certain knowledge of your customer, you may know the names of your customer's clients due to an ongoing business relationship, do not agree that you are being given that information as confidential when it is something you already know without the obligation of protection. Number four, do not agree that everything you learn or receive is automatically confidential. Ask that confidential information delivered to you be clearly identified as such, and that oral confidential information be summarized in writing and given to you in written format. Companies which take seriously the need to protect their confidential information know that not every single piece of paper qualifies as such. As a business owner, you should be willing to protect the other party's confidential information, but not extend that definition to information which is either already public or already known to you through other sources. And number five, do look for an expiration date for this obligation. Open-ended obligations are extremely difficult to keep track of, and you will want to create a system for tracking your confidentiality obligations as soon as you start to accumulate agreements. A confidentiality agreement, which has no expiration date, is like a ticking time bomb sitting in your file cabinet, just waiting for the right moment or wrong moment from your point of view to explode. If properly drafted, that means tailored for the specific situation, not just printed out like so many boilerplate documents. A confidentiality agreement can define a careful best practices method for small business owners to come together and do business, knowing that they have taken steps to protect much of their company's precious assets. It also gives the other party the impression that you take your business issues seriously and adds a layer of credibility that goes a long way in a newly developing relationship. A confidentiality agreement can be a benefit and a burden, so treat it with the care and respect it deserves. Thanks for listening. For more information, please visit us at www.widettandmccarthy.com.